Shellfish Growers Association. We represent shellfish growers all the way up and down the West Coast.
Christina Lee, Governor's Natural Resource Policy Office.
Captain Nayer, I'm with Case U Godspeed.
Bill Hanschmaker, I'm with Oregon State University of Natural Resources.
Good morning, I'm Mark Labhart. I have the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner.
Michael Cito, a Tillamook County resident.
Ruth Craig, a resident.
And thank you so much for being here with us today. And please.
Debbie Malone, committee staff.
Smith, who went to staff.
Mark Wagner, shellfish grower, New Jersey Bayward.
Molly, I'm a state representative. Thank you.
Great. I think we've covered everyone. On our agenda today, the most of this meeting is going to be taken up by an informational meeting. But while we're waiting for Senator Johnson to join us today, I'm going to skip down the agenda and make some housekeeping announcements. First of all, if anyone came in after we made the announcement about parking, all of the parking places out front of the building need to be kept free in case there is an event and responders need to park. So if you parked out front, please grab your keys and go move your car to the back parking lot, and we'll try and remind anyone else that comes in that they need to park in the back. We will be, after our informational meeting, moving over to the Schooner for lunch. And just so that you all know, this is a formal task force. There is a quorum involved. So we need you to take your task force hats off if you're officially a member and enjoy your lunch in a very casual way. We won't be discussing any of the major issues before us as a task force while we're at lunch, so that we're honoring the open meetings laws that are that we are being regulated by. So just keep that in mind as we're chatting and enjoying the beautiful coastal air. Beth and I were just having a discussion about our next meeting, and we were looking at May 26th. It seems as though that day may be problematic. So she will be contacting you all to see if possibly May 31st or June 3rd would work. So just tuck that away somewhere, and Beth will contact you, and we'll see what works for the largest number of the group. The location of that meeting will most likely be at the Oregon Institute of Marine Biology down in Charleston. So instead of being the longest traveler today, Don will probably be the shortest traveler.
By a couple miles,
yeah.
Unless Steve's there, in which case he's got us all beat.
There you go.
Yes.
So she will be contacting you then. The topic of that up-and-coming meeting is water quality and monitoring, wild shellfish stocks, recreational harvest, native shellfish restoration, and site sustainability. And the subgroup 3-4 planning for that meeting, for the April meeting is Claire, Steve, Dick, Jess, and Dawn. So we have kind of a switching of the guard for the subgroups for that meeting. Well, there's some discussion about what we need to do to wrap this up. So none of this is written in stone. These are just suggestions, and I think as we get closer, we will figure this out. But there will be a meeting subsequent to that, more than likely Thursday, July the 21st. That will be in Salem. And at that point, we will be looking at the economics of the industry. And we are trying to decide, and I think we'll decide at that meeting, if we need one more subsequent meeting to wrap up in mid-August, early September to finalize the report. So we may or may not, depending on how much work we get done between now and then. So if we're diligent and come up with some legislative recommendations, maybe we won't. If we don't, we'll have one more meeting probably later in August. And in this afternoon, the tour of the Whiskey Creek Hatchery between 2 and 2:50, we've been asked to do the tour first, then we'll go down and look at all the educational signs that it sounds like are something that I have not seen and would enjoy seeing. Some of you may have seen them, but we will take a look at those as we depart. And I think Mr. Barton and Mark are going to be leading the charge on the tour. So thank you so much for having us today. And in the absence of Senator Johnson, I think we're just going to keep plowing on through. She can get caught up when she gets here. Pardon me? Senator, your timing could not be more perfect.
Oh. I think she always does that.
And if you parked in front, you need to move your car. Senator? Did you park in the front?
I did.
Can we have somebody move your car for you? The cars need to be parked in the back.
Sure. There you go. Mark's driven it before not to be hurt by falling debris.
There you go. All we have done so far, Senator, is go through introductions, and we jumped down on the agenda, went through all the announcements, and now we are ready to start our informational meeting. So
cool. Well, I had to do a little radio show and tell them.
Your timing is impeccable.
Cool.
And for the record, Senator Johnson just joined us. First on our agenda today is an overview of best management practices for shellfish mariculture. And Dr. Rumrell, take it away.
Okay, as we work through our work plan, this meeting is an informational meeting just to provide background information that the task force needs to
sharing a highlighter today.
Make recommendations about our involvement in helping develop up best management practices for commercial mariculture as part of the task force implementation strategy in the future. So I'm going to talk, just give you some background information here for about 10 minutes on just what best management practices are and where we have been here in Oregon. And again, I'm Steve Rumrell, Shellfish Program Leader for ODFW. Let me make sure I make this work. Nope. Beth, can you help me figure out which one again?
Oh, does she need
switch on the
there we go.
Okay.
There we go. Okay, I got it. So just to remind you, House Bill 2209 that we passed last year identified the need to develop best management practices as a component of the overall Oregon Shellfish Initiative. That's our job, is to develop up just what those components are. The specific language, of course, is that the task force will develop up a draft shellfish initiative. We're working to identify the priorities for research and research funding. And then here, we were asked to develop up best management practices through cooperative efforts between commercial and recreational shellfish industries in cooperation with state and federal agencies and also in cooperation with academic scientists. That's our job, is to put together just the framework for these best management practices. Well, what are best management practices? Again, as defined in House Bill 2209, those are planning actions or actual mariculture operations and techniques on the ground. It's that whole mix that are consistent with the conservation of wild shellfish stocks and shellfish habitats. That's the language that's in our House Bill. So our goal, really, for the task force meeting today is to provide the background information to help with our discussion later on about best management practices. To look at that a little bit more, again, to emphasize, in House Bill 2209, these are planning actions and mariculture operation techniques consistent with conservation of wild shellfish stocks and habitats. Another way to think about best management practices, that's the group of mutually agreed upon actions and procedures followed to protect estuarine habitats, conserve living resources, and to ensure regulatory compliance during commercial shellfish growing and harvest operations. Others have defined them in different ways as well, but it's really just to try to make sure that we're operating in a manner that is both profitable for industry, in compliance with our regulations, and consistent with conservation along the coast.
Yep. I guess I would have to ask, at what table is this mutually agreed upon actions and procedures? Where are they mutually agreed upon?
Yes, good point. So my understanding is that the best management practices that have been developed for the West Coast here happened through the agreement happened at the level of workshops, series of workshops up and down the coast. I think that's also the way that happened for the East Coast and for British Columbia. So the agreement happens in pulling together group discussions and then synthesizing that into the document. I'm not sure if they were there's a requirement for agreement by the agencies to sign off on them. I don't really know. We'll have to ask Margaret for some.
I guess I'm faintly lost. I don't know whether you're speaking in past tense that this activity has already happened, and that if I went to any of the producers and say, are these mutually agreed upon actions and procedures, and are they reflected in statute, the mutual agreement, and are they reflected in rule, the mutual agreement, or are you looking prospectively to a time where we can adaptively manage the best practices, or that we're going to sit down and talk about what they are?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I think the procedural part of that, the answer is both. Here on the West Coast, we have a set of
best management practices, environmental codes of practice that I'm going to get into in just a second, that were agreed upon by those workshops in about 2001. And what I'm, just to jump right to it, I'm going to call for us to relook at those, to update them, revise them, so we'd end up going through that process.
As part of this process.
As part of the shellfish initiative.
You're referencing the PCSGA?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll get to those in a second. I think it'll help as we get through those.
So just to make sure I'm with you, would you agree that they are mutually agreed upon as a producer, or are these regulations that have been done to you rather than with you? Do you feel like you're a full partner?
I feel like I'm a full partner. They were done before my time. So like Steve says, we do need to go over them and make sure they're current and work for Oregon specific as well.
But I'm good with that.
The member PCSGA members as a whole all got on board with it, and it was went through the board. Correct me if I'm wrong, Margaret.
Yeah, Steve, I don't know if you want me to chime in now or if you want to.
We have a big block of time. I just wanted to kind of lay out the stage, and then we'll dig into the guts of them.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. The major point I wanted to make here, though, is that the benefits of best management practices are that they smooth this all out. So the operators, the agencies, stakeholders, academia, NGOs, tribes, everybody who's had some part in seeing them developed up will be familiar with the whole scope of understanding what happens. Svein, you've made the point several times that that folks who are chiming in don't really have the feel for what it takes to grow oysters on the ground.
Right.
And by having everybody involved in crafting up and understanding what the best management practices are, our collective understanding of what it takes to grow oysters, to deal with the regulatory side, to deal with the recreational impacts, all of those, I think it just elevates everybody's understanding, really smooths it out, is my feeling. Okay, so just a quick history.
Well, one more question. Yeah. I'm sorry to be such a pain, but given that they're smoothed out and given that everybody's agreed, is it safe to say that there's no likelihood that somebody's going to bolt from the table and file a lawsuit? That's become the way that we're doing best management anymore. It's who's got the best lawyer and who can get into court. I'm just trying to understand whether or not, because we've made the foundational effort to find common ground, is that a prophylactic against some group suing somebody?
Hard for me to answer that question. Margaret, do you want to chime in on that?
Sorry.
I know that they, you know, we can get into it a little bit more, but I think the best management practices have been voluntary
right.
for your members, correct?
Yes. So without stealing too much of Steve's thunder, the Environmental Code of Practices, which is a compilation of all of our, the BMPs, or best practices, was developed by PCSGA, it is a trade association. And so members are, you know, supposed to follow those. You know, they are voluntary. We don't have all of the members in our, all the shellfish growers in our association, however, though. So there may still be some people who are not very familiar with this suite of best practices. And this suite of practices could be the starting point for Oregon to talk about what Oregon would want to see, but this is for the whole West Coast. And the members, as Svein said, the members of the association all sort of worked on this together, and there is this mutual agreement. Can someone still sue us on it? I guess so, but it's not required. So there isn't really much legal standing
And Senator, I might suggest, since this conversation will continue through the morning, that Margaret, would you like to just come up here and join us at the table?
Yeah, good idea.
It might be a little easier. and I'd like
sure
to also note that Claire Thomas has arrived, so we have a full complement. So thank you, Claire, for being here.
I guess
Margaret's moving over. Oh, go ahead.
When I think best management practices, and Margaret and I kind of had this conversation earlier, that because the growers agree with it and ODF&W agrees with it, or this task force puts it together and there's actually a bill, but if Army Corps or somebody comes down the road with more regulations, it might override anything we do anyway. So there's so many agencies, it's not just state. You get into federal level. So I don't know. It's something to keep in our heads of how does that even tie together. Just because we're doing something, we all agree it's right. NIMS might not.
Yes.
Well, one thing if I could throw it out too is, you know, at the port level, we've been talking to quite a few people. We, you know, with this committee, we've been talking about oysters and oysters and oysters. There has been an interest, and I see an increase in clamming as well as far as the farming. We had a lot of interest in starting to farm raised clams, and I just hope we don't go down one road that might handicap that industry as it grows as well too. So I think we should be keeping that in mind as we're talking about this stuff.
Thank you.
And that was one of our original things too, is make sure we get the language changed to where we can do clams.
Right, we don't handicap that.
And this is a shellfish task force, yeah.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about oysters, scope, so we want to make sure we don't forget about the clams.
Thank you for that.
Okay, back on this, so just quick history. The Pacific Shellfish Growers Association developed sort of three levels of these best management practices. The first is their environmental policy statement, which is available to everybody on the web. That was developed back in 2001. And Margaret, I believe that was put together, it was about $30,000 worth of Sea Grant support, I think, to develop that. Three states all kicked in to develop this policy statement. Second, the environmental codes of practice, which are more detailed and include operational guidelines all the way down through siting, permitting, handling of brood stock, just really all the way down to the farm level, followed the next year. And I believe that was money from...
It was another grant.
Another grant.
And then there was a grant in 2011 to update it slightly, just to make it more current, but not to change any of the underpinnings.
I'd like to just flag this and ask the professional staff to keep track of it. You've been operating on grants to try to do some of this. I don't know whether they're state or federal grants. But I think we ought to, as we're building towards our final set of recommendations, that if there needs to be grant funding or legislative funding to sustain the work, to keep the collaborative work going, we ought to be able to monetize it to know what to ask for if we're putting together a suite of funding.
And then just continue to highlight what Mike said about the broad scope of the task force. It's not just oysters, but clam production as well.
The third level, and Svein will describe this later on this morning, is working with the Pacific Shellfish Growers Association to develop the best management practices for the individual farm. So they're tailor-made then to each farming operation. Okay, so we've got these three levels: broad guidelines at the policy level, environmental code of practice for best management practices for the whole West Coast, and then at the individual level of farms. At that general principle level of environmental policy, this document addresses environmental stewardship and responsible management. Very nice statements there. Statement about environmental excellence, striving for excellence in everything that they're doing on the environmental side, for compliance with the regulatory environment at the state and federal level and local level, for dealing with waste management issues, and also sharing of resources, both financial resources and intellectual resources, and also referring to the scientific expertise within the Pacific Shellfish Institute, which is science technical in support. And I believe that these are still relevant, even though that was drafted back in 2001, and the work at the consensus level happened prior to that. Many of these things are still relevant in 2016. The Environmental Codes of Practice chapters, here's just a quick table of contents just to describe the scope of those in terms of description of the industry, environmental health impacts, general management principles, predator control, the operations within the hatcheries and out on the farms, et cetera, dealing with everything else on here. Several of those elements are still relevant. As Margaret's pointed out, some of them have been updated in 2011, but anyways, there's been lots of progress and changes since that time. And it's my feeling, and I hope to convince the task force as well, that I think we would benefit by doing an update of the broad scale codes of practice. And it's not our business to deal with the individual farms, but at this level, I think that we certainly could update these.
Can that happen voluntarily, or should we build that into a legislative recommendation?
That's exactly where I'm going here.
Oh, cool.
Okay. So, and I'll get to that in a second. If we compare how did our neighbors, again, Senator Johnson, to use your term, let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's look at the successes of our neighbors. Best management practices for the East Coast shellfish industry. Those were developed up and published in 2010. Very similar in terms of the table of contents, dealing with permitting, siting issues, good neighbor policies, the seed sources, operations at the hatcheries and at the level of the field, the disease issue, shellfish sanitation, human health, all those kind of things that we're concerned about. There's a nice template put together by the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association. How about up north, British Columbia? British Columbia, very similar pathway, published theirs in 2011 and just updated it in 2013. You go online, pull that up, whole suite of issues there too, another 100 pages or so of nice detailed template up north. So I think the task ahead for us, just to feed into what Senator Johnson just asked me, I think that in the time frame for the Shellfish Initiative, that early start, one of the tasks should be to update those best management practices for Oregon. But we could do that on behalf of the larger region, or could do that in cooperation with our colleagues in Washington and California. We need to build on the expertise, the previous work, the good work that has happened at the PCSGA level industry to develop their environmental policy and existing codes of practice, but also input from the federal, state, local agencies that have responsibilities for public trust and permitting, from the coastal tribes that are affected. Really great input from the academics here in Oregon, as you've heard of some of them. Some of them working again with Mark on the ocean acidification hatchery level, other scientists up at the University of Washington, others down in Northern California, lots of good input there. And then also input from the non-governmental organizations and public stakeholders who also have been doing great work along these lines. So we need to build on that from there. And that's the job, then, to update, revise, and develop those broader best management practices for commercial shellfish mariculture and harvest operations along the coast. I think that would be a nice thing for us to do. And with that, I think I'll stop and pass it over to Svein.
Hand off.
Yeah. So I was just going to do just a brief. When you talk about best management, it's hard to cover everything that the farms do, because our operations do different things than Jesse does. I just wish I gotta find it. Washington has a lot more culture methods than Oregon uses. East Coast uniquely different from us again, and even BC is different. So how do you come up with something that encompasses what everybody does without actually, in a way, hog-tying people from being innovative and moving forward? So for those that haven't been on a farm, I was just going to do, I think I got 18 or 19, just quick pictures kind of showing what we do here in Tillamook, which is pretty common throughout Oregon. Mark, you might do some things a little bit different with bags or anything. You're all ground? Okay. So, this is, for the life of me, I couldn't find a picture of a whole shell bag that we get, but this is a picture of a shell in a bag after they come out of the hatchery. This particular one happens to be a long line, which I'll show you what that is later, but those are all little baby oysters attached to the mother shell. Same thing, here's a long line later in life. That's probably 3 or 4 months down the road during a good growing season. That one, that's, again, later in life, still on a long line, but that's, you know, 20 oysters on one cluster. So that one shell has all those oysters attached to it. This is what, when you hear the term long line, it is the poles stretched out. It's about 100-foot rope with shells strung through it. The reason growers use this is, one, they grow faster, they're up out of the ground, and in exposed areas like certain sections of Tillamook Bay, you don't lose your product. If you put it on the ground, it's got really hard, sandy bottom, those oysters will just wash away when we get our storms. So it's a way to get away from that. Some growers...
those stakes have to go to get...
15 inches.
15 inches.
Yep. Real quick question. So when we get the south winds blowing 60 miles an hour across Tillamook County, taking Greenwater and Garibaldi, how do your farms hold up, or your plots hold up?
These do awesome.
Yeah.
So there's a notch cut in that pipe. We go down about 2 inches, force that rope through it, and by the time those clusters get pretty big, that's a lot of weight. So sometimes the rope will break, but we've never actually lost. Our biggest problem is driftwood in Tillamook.
Oh, driftwood will take them out.
Stump coming through, we end up with a big mess at the end, but we haven't lost anything.
Do you have to, when you harvest, do those stakes stay there, or do you have to reset the stakes every time?
Those stay there. We usually, it takes about a year and a half, 2 years for a grow out, mm-hmm. for those would be ready for harvest, and as soon as we harvest them, we'll restring them.
And is there a direction to current that's important?
A lot of farmers will go in a current direction. We tend to go in prevailing wind, so they're not sitting crosswise to the waves.
Okay.
We'll point them into the waves.
Okay.
Here. Some growers will use this. So a lot of guys are doing this in Washington now in areas where the sand shrimp have moved in, where the ground won't hold the ground moisture, they'll sink, they'll put holes in instead.
And is having them out of that benthic environment, or whatever you want to call it, is it that a healthier environment to grow in as well because they're not touching?
More of the oysters are going to survive because none of them suffocate by being in the mud.
Okay.
Because the oysters
have
open
the silt's
feet.
The problem.
Right.
Not necessarily their bugs are easier to get into them, or worms, or they're not exposed anymore.
Right. Okay. Again, we don't have a predation problem in Tillamook other than shrimp, sand shrimp. So Washington, I believe crab is an issue in some areas, drills, things like that. We don't have those here, luckily. So.
Okay, thanks.
So there's kind of a bigger area. Much nicer on my computer screen. But you can see, as they grow here, that went way faster. So the other would be for ground culture, where we actually, it's just the individual shell, again, no line this time, where they'll come at high tide with the boats and spread those out over the marked beds. We use what I call the whirly wheel to do it. It's just paddle wheel that spins, dump the bags on it. Some physical labor, some shoveling, sometimes not. So this is a ground bed oysters.
What determines which technique you use?
State.
Yeah, this to some degree the state and what you're permitted to.
So it's a different permit for staking than it is ground grow.
Right.
Okay.
Some of our grants has to be ground culture. Some of them has to be long lines. Some of them can be both.
When the plant is applied for or issued, then these conditions applied to that, which are written in to the ground certificate.
And there's, I'm assuming, some reason for why it's recommended
they
use.
Some of them are like really old plants, and so everything's grandfathered and you can pretty much do anything you want, and the more recent ones are much more restrictive, and that's through the whole public process and then government agencies weighing in, but Fish and Wildlife, federal agencies, and then we come up with what is considered an appropriate land use for that particular piece of land.
We can have a sidebar on this later, but what would determine the difference between this and using lines or using bags, something else? What determines that?
I think in some cases it's just like public access. I mean, when you've got the lines across there, there's a lot of boat traffic. I mean,
okay.
They'll get snarled up, and just and then the appearance of it is, having
PVC
stakes out there, it looks a little bit less, it's more unsightly, I guess, than just having what looks like rocks.
It's not necessarily science. It's more.
Yeah, it's land use, so everything
it's
comes
both.
Into it.
It's both.
Yeah, go ahead.
more recently, there's generally site visits if you're platting an area that hasn't previously been platted. So there would be eelgrass mitigation. Is there other animals present? Is it a heavily trafficked area by fishermen? Yes. Things like that. And that's how they come up with, like, we have a plat up by the Ghost Hole, real close to Garibaldi. That one specifically spells out that we have to have it marked really well so that boat operators know we're there.
Okay.
Yeah. Oddly enough, that one's only permitted for long lines, which really doesn't make sense because there's a lot of boat traffic there.
There's a lot of lines in the water.
There's a lot of lines in the water. So we're constantly finding lures and stuff, and that's one that we're going to work with the state on seeing if we can adjust that.
Okay.
That's what I was going to ask. How long would it take to change the permit? Let's say you discover there's an issue like this, or be more profitable to make more money by changing a different technique. How long does the regulatory process take to make a change?
I've actually gone through those steps with John Byers on that particular plat to change it.
Mm-hmm.
The changing was easy. I think it got a public notice, $250 fee to the state. The reason we ended up not changing it is we couldn't get mechanical harvesting on that plat. So we could get ground culture, but we couldn't get mechanical harvesting. And
don't you have to worry about siltation there as well?
Not up there so much. Yes and no. I think I worry about that in all of Tillamook, to be honest with you. That far out is not as bad as further in. But that particular, and now we get into oyster farming terminology, I need a -1 tide to even get my walk that bed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't either harvest, the long lines we can pull with a boat, if it's on the ground, we have to hand pick it. They won't let us pull it with the boat. I only get 30 days a year I can actually walk that piece of ground, and it's 100 acres. It is physically impossible for us to harvest that ground. So we backed off on it.
So for clarification, when you say you couldn't
walk it,
when you couldn't harvest it, you couldn't, what did you say? You couldn't dredge it?
Mechanically dredge it.
You could mechanically dredge it. It wasn't because that was also in the permit or the, what was,
when it was originally platted,
constraints of
the original guy who got it didn't want, he wanted to do long lines, but
so
discovered he couldn't really line. Do it because
it was the traffic.
Interesting.
So I have kind of a question for ODA. Is there any regular provision for reviewing permitting at this point? I mean, do you look every 5 or 10 years at a permit and say, well, does this type
still
of operation
fit?
Still fit, or is it, there's nothing, no review at this point?
If you wanted to go through and change a condition in a permit, you actually run the risk of losing that altogether, because you have to go all the way back to the start and go through public hearing for most of those things. And
we didn't have to change the conditions. Put it out there and people could do written comments, but you didn't have to do the hearings. So all the agencies provided input and the public could provide input.
But an agency, a federal agency, could say, actually, we decided now we don't want anything on this piece of land, and so.
Right. Well, my question would be, you know, the reoccurring theme with everything we do nowadays is how many agencies have conflicting input? How many agencies have input or could throw a wrench in a plan for a superfluous reason or a legitimate reason to change?
A lot.
That, you know, because that's one of the things we keep coming up against in everything we do is how many different agencies, and all of a sudden an agency we never even heard of before has a little thing, a little caveat that you throw a wrench in everything. So
just make sure I understand then. You may not, as a grower, want to open up the permitting process because it opens up just too many complex issues and you don't know where it'll
right.
go.
I think
you may find yourself
the
in a worse position than when you started.
This,
sure
the way this did. One worked for us was when we saw the restrictions that were going to be put on us, we were able to just say, you know what, we changed our mind.
Stop the process.
Stop the process.
Yeah.
We stopped the process.
Okay.
If I can add a little more clarification, as Alex pointed out, some of the leases have been in operation for many, many years. We call those legacy leases. Mm-hmm. They've been there for a long, long time, and they're very open in terms of things. And some of the newer leases that have gone through this then are much more restrictive in terms of the types of operation, which species can be grown there. So it depends on what kind of lease.
And on the
is.
Review, I would say, I mean, it should be up to the individual grower if they want to change what they're doing. Obviously, they have to go back to the agencies if they're making significant changes. Mm-hmm. But as for agency review or ODA coming out and visiting the sites, that should be more of a, are you following the rules that were put on you? I don't think agencies should necessarily be telling you this might be better or at that point if it's already agreed upon.
So your inability, just take your committee head off for a second, your inability to manage that plat by the ghost hole the way that you should or could or best practices would allow you to, how has that impacted your overall operation in numbers?
You said you can't harvest it, so
it's part of that is staffing issues too. I have to, you know, we used to be able to get 10, 15, 20 employees throughout the summer. Then it becomes possible.
Well, let me rephrase.
It's a workforce issue.
If you were able to farm that the way that you would work best for you, what would that do?
Oh.
Instead of the handicap, how could that increase your production or?
Probably at least 20-25% a year over what we're doing now.
Off of that 100 acres.
Yeah. Because we could split that into we would split it into thirds and have a 3-year crop rotation going.
This just comes back to one of the statements we made a long time ago, trying to best utilize the plats that are already laid out versus trying to find new established ones or stuff
that are
like
going to have restrictions. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it sound like it was the agencies or anything. We just, at that point, we didn't have time to deal with it and go through everything to get it changed.
But I'm curious if this is a workforce issue for you, and that's why you're not harvesting that now.
No, we do have product on it, mm-hmm. but we're probably only using a third of it versus all of it.
And is that because of the workforce piece?
That's a big workforce piece, yes.
Okay.
But I could work it with 2 to 3 personnel. If it was ground culture,
if you ran it differently, you could work it with fewer personnel.
Yeah, 2 to 3 people.
Okay,
and
it's just the way it's set up right now.
Right,
you need more.
Yeah.
Okay.
It also raises the interesting question about being able to implement better practices with the uncertainty of changing any of your regulatory architecture.
Mm-hmm.
You might find a way to do this more ecologically soundly. And you're too frightened by the regulatory overlay to ask for an implementation plan because you could get screwed out of the whole thing.
Right.
That's really backwards.
That's a reoccurring issue in a lot of things. I mean, you know, when you have these legacy leases or legacy permits, you're afraid to try
right.
to update things because you may not be able to do it at all.
And one of the things I was going to suggest we look at to write into something like this is, you know, if I have a 100-acre lease and I came to ODA and said, you know, we really want to test out this new growing method, you know,
now we're going to 11.
An acre or 5-acre maximum or something to where you could do a test plot without going through everything where everybody could look at it and see what the impact or no impact or how it works. And that would tell the grower more, is this something I want to do?
Do you have any plats in Neatarts Bay that are like this?
Hey, and Mark, do you want to come up and join us as well?
You mean a ground culture like this?
Or just any of the terms of a current permit that aren't really working in your best interest, but you can't.
Our ground's different in Neatarts. It's fairly hard bottom. So it's all primarily ground culture. But we're not at this scale. Mom and pop operations out there, but it's just we don't do long lines out there. I don't think anybody, maybe Alex can answer this. I don't think anybody has a permit to do long lines and Neatarts. Off bottom culture is what we call it.
Was there somebody who applied for the flip bags or something?
Travis is doing those.
Who?
Travis is doing those floating cage things, isn't he?
Yeah, but is that considered off bottom? I consider that ground bottom culture
on floats.
But, you
yeah.
know, it's because but when it's
not
suspended,
strung across
right,
some pipes.
When it's suspended, it's obviously off bottom, but it's just a way of holding product bottom.
Mark, are the permits in Neatart's legacy permits primarily? Or not?
Yeah.
They are?
Yeah. I mean, there was, I think, a few plots that came up recently that it had to go through the application process. And it was
they changed hands?
Yeah, some have changed hands in which you inherit those regulations on there, but there's also been a plot or two out there that are new, but my belief is it's all bottom culture. Okay. So really to go off bottom is like a step up, you know.
Well, my question would be, you know, we had talked, I think probably at the first meeting, about one of the issues was there are a lot of plats that aren't getting used at all, but they're being held onto by the leaseholder because they, you know, they know if they give them up, they'll never get them back again. And we had discussed how to make them more productive. And if, you know, I think we'd use what we're doing in the port with borings, you know, if you don't utilize it over a certain period of time, then it has to come up for review. But then the scary thing is if that starts to happen, what happens? Would somebody new be able to come in and take over a plat, or because of all these changes in regs, would if that person lets go of that plat for a reason, would it never be able to be farmed again because of changes in regulations? Does that make sense?
I think if it goes back to the state, it would probably get reviewed to some degree.
And that's kind of, I think, what we were talking about. Because, like, you know, there's certain plats, like a big operation, they're part of a big cycle. And they could sit 4 or 5 years and not get used. But if there's a few of those people that aren't even in the industry anymore, aren't even doing it, and there's plats that are sitting there, they're still leasing and not using, there's production that could be using them. So instead of trying to go out and establish new plats, try to repurpose some of the ones that aren't being used, I'm just afraid if they go back to the state, they may get lost to the industry.
I get to say that, there's plats in Tillamook Bay owned by others that I'd love to have that nobody's used in 8 years that I know of, you know, that are grid growing down that we'd love to use.
And I think that's something we need to look at as a recommendation, because if they go back to the state and get reviewed, he may, or these guys may never even be able to pick those up, and we might be kind of going back to where we were, having to reestablish stuff from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
I think a simple way to approach that would be look at the harvest records. You know, if it's absolutely dormant for X number of years, it's a pretty good indicator that you got ground that's not being utilized.
Right, but the fear is that if it goes back to the state, how could it come to you free and clear?
You lose your legacy status, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we know which plats are in production and which aren't.
And that would be, could ODA say plat X hasn't been used for so long? Is there anybody else who's interested in taking that plat directly right now?
That's normally what we try to do. If I have a pretty good idea of who's interested in growing, you know, who wants more ground. And so if there is one of those plats, and this happened in Neatarts, I approached a couple of people and said, look, why don't you go and contact this guy and see if he wants to do a deal with you and sell this back
sell
to
the
you.
Permit.
Right.
Yeah.
And just do it between the two of you. Because the state can't take, I mean, if we could force the abandonment of that plat, we can do that, no problem. I mean, it takes work, but once that's abandoned, then that's gone. I mean, that plat doesn't exist anymore. So anyone that wants to go in there goes from square one, creates the polygon, and
so
then
sunsetting
goes through
the process. That permit may not be the best idea.
But isn't that something that we talked about wanting to try to get out of this, is to create the mechanism for an easier transfer of those things so they don't get lost?
Person to person, it's easy.
It is,
but can we create something from the state takes it, but we don't lose?
Because there are people that
the legacy.
The legacy.
Yeah, there are people that hold on to things. And again, I just go back to the slips. You know, we have a couple slips in the port that nobody wants to give up, but they haven't had a boat in them for 2 decades. And, you know, we created ordinances to, you know, if you ain't using them, you're going to lose them kind of thing. And do we want to put something into this recommendation that's a mechanism for the state to do if somebody has not used it? Because we can't create a bunch more plats. There's some out there that could be helping the industry out that aren't getting used, and the permit holders are not willing to let go of them because, for whatever reason, and you approach them and they don't want to make those deals. So is there some mechanism that we can create where they can be forced back into the queue and available to other growers, without having to lose their status or lose anything.
Right.
That's kind of the point I was trying to get at.
I could talk to Jim Johnson about that, and maybe the state can then be like the de facto permit holder until someone else decides they want to move in there. And
with a certain, I would, I mean, there should be a time limit on it, obviously, okay. too, but.
Couldn't you just reserve them for shellfish use into the future?
That's what I need to, I'm not sure. My understanding is that if we abandon a plat, then it's gone. It just disappears. So, but I'm not, and maybe that could be an easy statutory change that we could do that.
Washington State has Bush and Callow Act lands, and those were lands, gosh, close, well, they've been in place for decades. Do you know, is this even close to statehood? But the idea is that under both of those acts, those lands are reserved for shellfish. And if they're not being used, they revert back to the state, but they maintain that
it
shall be used.
Status
for
doesn't
shellfish.
Change.
Status doesn't change.
I think that's what we need to be looking at. It would be nice if we could look at it so we're not losing ground.
Yeah.
So I think, to your point, you just mentioned a little bit earlier in your comment was, I think a bigger problem is trying to open up new ground for cultivation. I see that as a bigger problem than this thing of what do you do with ground that's just sitting there fouling. Somebody wants to come in and...
And this ties into the oyster, if we're starting to get people who want to start doing the clamming, we're getting more interested in farming clams, there's going to be a need for some more land out there.
And that's, the clam thing is, it's something that we're definitely interested in pursuing in Tolma, but, and Steve might be able to speak, that discussion we have with Matt on what that all is going to entail, it sounds like it's just a language change.
Yeah, I presented that at the last task force meeting. So, again, there are existing Oregon revised statutes that govern which animals can be brought in, which non-native species can be brought in, and which ones can't. And so we do have restrictions on that right now. In addition, ODA also has restrictions on.
And I wasn't there, so I'm not sure what. But.
And are those restrictions harmonized in any way, or do they have their whole set of regulatory stuff? And what I'm trying to figure out are these multiple layers of regulations.
Well, we did. That was the purpose of our last task force meeting, is we presented that sequence of those. So, we entered all of that into the record to see which ones there are. I think they're in pretty close harmony.
So, quick question. Maybe there's a quick answer, but from my discussion with Matt was, since we do it with oysters, but it's all based on health certificates and health checks, my impression from him was he didn't feel like it would be very hard, or he didn't see a reason if the hatchery that the clams came from had the same certifications and same tests for clams as they did for the oysters, why we couldn't do it relatively.
It's possible. Again, at the agency worker bee level, Matt and myself, we don't have the authority to change these things. So as Oregon revised statutes, the lawmakers have to do that, if it's a rule, then our collective agency commissions have their, so we would have to take
health,
that forward to them.
The steward of the safe health of the shellfish coming into the state, I guess he didn't see a problem with it. It was all in the rules and the language he's dealing with.
Well, just kind of going against the tide here, I had a question based on what happened in Washington Redux. So when you change from oysters to clams from your plat, you're going to be changing not only the species, but how it's planted and how it's harvested. And that has a big impact on the surrounding property owners, for example. In the case of the gooey duck, it had to do with the litter that was left on and the harvest trap mechanisms, the effect it would have on eelgrass. In that sense, you would think that if you're going to change what you're harvesting, that it needs to be reviewed to avoid those kinds of things.
The plats would most definitely have to be reviewed and the permits reissued with whatever recommendations or restrictions. You're absolutely, because you are changing everything. So they wouldn't fit under most of the existing permits to start with, because they specifically say oysters. There's one plat, 5 acres in Tillamook, that's actually approved by ODA to grow clams.
Would you see, if clams became part of your guys' business model, would you see shifting back and forth almost like a farmer shifts between corn and something else, or
no? Clams,
grow on one substrate, oysters grow on another.
Well, I'm speaking to the ability to change usage of a plat. You know, and I know it's not going to be every year, but you know, over a decade back and forth is.
I don't think so. I don't. Margaret might know. People that do clams in Washington, their ground, the clam ground is clam ground. They don't switch back and forth to oysters.
Not so much switching back and forth, but I do know that there is some area that where there's clam and then oysters on bottom on top of the clam. Mm-hmm.
On long lines or on the?
No, not necessarily long. Yeah, bottom culture. I know that a lot of the Taylor beds in Oakland Bay have clams, and then the Kumamoto's just
grow on top.
They'd be beach hardened on top.
The current way Oregon permits are issued, is that would that not be allowed, or would that be?
I don't think that would be allowed.
The way the permits, I don't.
It's just
besides the one plat in Tillamook, I don't think there's anything else anywhere in Oregon.
There'll have to be some changes to incorporate clams.
Well, is it my understanding
that it should be reviewed?
Yeah.
Clams are a recreational fishery. So if you have clams on your ground, oyster ground, then that would not keep somebody out from going in there and getting clams.
But I think part of this conversation, too, is can we go the next step and commercialize the clam industry as well?
There's a lot of interest in commercializing the human edible clamming industry.
Right.
The hard part there would, how would the poor OS be trooper? Now, if somebody comes in with a bucket of oysters right now, he knows they're not allowed to have them because they're all commercial. Now, somebody comes in with a bucket of steamer clams from somewhere they grow native and there's a clam farm. How is that trooper going to know whether that person is there?
Yeah, if I can add to clarify in support of both of these statements, these areas that are leased are actually open for recreational clamming.
Now.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when a commercial lease owner gets the lease there, they have the ability to grow the shellfish on there, but they don't have the ability to exclude a recreational clammer from just walking right out there and digging clams. So we have, I know. And it's a gorilla in the room kind of issue because there's a, you know, it's open public land. You have the ability to cultivate shellfish on there. But as you guys pointed out, if somebody is collecting clams on there, it's hard to distinguish between the farmed product and the wild stock on that site. And
if
it would end up as an enforcement problem.
If you had a grower, though, introduce gooey duck into a plat that was only in that plat for commercial harvest, would that solve the problem? Because the OSP can tell the difference between a gooey duck and
right. And we do have some
then
gooey
it's a
ducks.
Take. Yeah.
There are some gooey ducks that occur here, but very, very rare. So that species would be distinguishable. You know,
but tied in.
But
like
I don't know if that's marketable.
Clam.
But
yeah.
Pardon me.
You could grow a Manila clam. Nobody can tell. I mean, everybody can tell the difference between a Manila clam and a.
Right, and that's what we would want to
grow. Yeah, so you grow something, some different species. There was a triploid.
But that's, 99.8% of the people stay out of our oyster beds. There's some that come in and they do shrimp and look for clams in there. That's no big deal. But if you were doing an actual clam farm, then yeah, maybe there's something you would want to do to protect the farmer. But I don't think it would be a huge problem. And it's pretty.
But the problem is saying legally they could go on there if you grew clams.
Yep.
And you
That's
could not
true.
Keep them off.
Yeah. There's nothing
you know,
we could do.
There's nothing you could do. They could go on. You could say, okay, I'm going to grow clams. Next thing you know, you got everybody out there digging your clams for you.
Not for you.
Taking them away. It's kind of like you pick and you just charge them when they leave. Blueberries do it.
Blueberry. Take. Goodbye.
Step one is we've got to get it.
But I think as a shellfish task force, this is part of the conversation we need to have if we're going to draft some sort of regulation that as we move forward, we keep an eye towards that.
It doesn't seem like a, you know, if it's a plat and it's properly marked, the trooper could sit there and watch people dig inside of that when they come out and say,
sorry.
You weren't allowed there, and it's properly marked the way the law says. But it's something that would have to be added.
We have about just a few more minutes, Fiend, to kind of wrap up. Yeah, thanks.
So this is out in the middle of Tillamook. It's another ground bed. I did that one. You kind of see, I mean, eelgrass and oysters interact, hang out together. That's up by the big dredge hole on the very west side of Tillamook Bay. these guys out hand-picking oysters, which is what we do most of the time. Our boats. So then they come back at high tide, pick these tubs of oysters up, bring them in the dock, and then so just get the picture there, didn't I? Come on. That is a lot of work. So this is what some of my people, the baskets. So it is a plastic basket that we put single seed oysters into.
Good conversation.
But that's one of those we're starting to test out. A lot of them in Washington, where they're actually able to grow the oysters as a single oyster. And you get a higher price for it. Consumers seem to want it.
Thank you.
Pretty similar in Coos Bay, pretty similar in Washington. Everybody does things just a little bit different.
Further questions for Spain?
I just wanted to make a comment about the clam discussion that currently that is any leases that we issue is clams are prohibited. So the only, we have a little exception for clams on leases that were issued before, I think 1997 or something. It's just an arbitrary number was put out. I'm not sure what this history behind it was, but any subsequent leases from that date, there's no clam
is
allowed at all. So,
thank you.
Mayor, I also would like to add, in response to a comment that Senator Johnson made about financing the Environmental Code of Practice, or BMP, there was a proposal that an organization called the Pacific Shellfish Institute submitted for federal funds. And they've actually done it twice, and it got kicked out twice here this year for round funding, but was to look at the best management practices for the West Coast industry and revise the Environmental Code of Practice, developing training modules for shellfish growers, and to get to something that Svein mentioned was this individual farm plan and create a template and provide training on how that would be done. And that project proposal was coming in at $150K.
It was rejected again?
It was.
Because it was badly written, or they didn't like the subject matter, or they didn't have any money?
Well, I think you never really know what the theme of the year is and that kind of thing. And maybe Steve has another idea, but they are evaluated.
Yeah, you know, we've put pressure, and I'll continue to do so, put pressure on Laura Hobrecht as our regional aquaculture coordinator to help us support development of our initiative here. And this seems like something that would be right up their alley.
Yeah.
And that's why I wanted to put that up there, and I flagged that the East Coast received money from the NOAA Aquaculture Center, from the East Coast Regional Center, to pay for that project in particular.
Yeah.
But when you mentioned that it was submitted for federal funding, there's myriad federal funds.
Yeah, it was SK. This one was an SK grant.
So
it's really competitive to get those funds.
Bill and I are nodding our heads. We know about that.
Oh, yeah.
But I think to the NOAA Aquaculture Center in particular, on the workforce and for the regional aquaculture centers, highly appropriate.
Yeah. And so I think that the fact that it's all packaged is helpful. I just think that it's up against some really other glamorous items, and we need advocates. And so it's sort of like legislation, at least in Washington. You hardly ever get it the first run. You got to keep trying.
Could you get a copy of that to our professional staff?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that would be
helpful.
I can
put you in contact with the person.
Okay. Thank you.
The game that's played, right? So you get the RFP that comes out of NOAA structured. So this is one of their high priorities. And that's by working with Laura and NOAA to get those RFPs designed that way. That's really, as you know, that's the key here.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
Moving along. Next on our list, we have Dr. Sally Hacker. Thank you for being here, Dr. Hacker.
Thank you. Great. Thank you for inviting me here today. Steve wanted me to come talk to you today about our research that we've done looking at how oyster aquaculture and eelgrass interact, and in particular, the research that we've done here in the Pacific Northwest. A lot of this work is from Willapa Bay, so I'll kind of give you that caveat. And not very much work has been done in Oregon, so hopefully this can be of help to you in terms of thinking about management practices.
It's a lot of, we were Steve and I were talking, everything's done in Washington. I mean, obviously the industry is huge there, but realistically, do you think the results of these studies would be any different?
Depends. I'll get to that in a minute. Yeah. So some of my collaborators, Brett Dumbald, Jennifer Rusink, who's up at University of Washington, and then my grad student, Margo Hessen-Lewis, who's in Canada now. So there's sort of three important considerations, I think, when we're looking at oyster aquaculture management and eelgrass. And those I have listed up here. The first is that the interaction can be both direct, so they're interacting directly, but also indirectly through, obviously, aquaculture practices. That spatial scale and temporal scales really are important in terms of mediating the interaction between these two things. So first of all, just recovery times. How long does it take for eelgrass to recover from particular aquaculture practices? And then looking at things both from a local oyster bed scale to kind of a larger, if you will, seascape or landscape scale. And that finally, the estuary that you look at matters. So estuary location is important in terms of this interaction, in particular because estuaries vary in terms of their exposure to ocean conditions, so ocean upwelling, as well as in terms of the river inputs into these systems. So just from a kind of, you know, stand back and look at what kind of interactions do oysters and eelgrass have with one another. We know that oysters benefit eelgrass in terms of looking at water quality, in terms of nutrients from the waste products of oysters. There are also some negative effects. Obviously, competition for space. They're both occurring in the same space. Eelgrass beds also can benefit oyster beds. We know that eelgrass obviously takes up CO2 as a primary producer and releases oxygen into those environments. And there's a lot of work now looking at the potential for eelgrass and macroalgae in terms of mediating ocean acidification. So can we use eelgrass and the production of eelgrass to help mitigate some of the effects of increasing CO2 in our waters? Obviously, there are negative effects in terms of eelgrass on oysters just because of the competition and potentially increased sediment deposition in areas where these two species co-occur. But, oops.
All these
buttons face more the and as
it's over here.
Yeah. Mentioned that there's an indirect effect of aquaculture, and that is through the disturbance that's associated with aquacultural practices. For example, and Sven really elegantly pointed out all the different types of practices that are occurring in the Pacific Northwest, dredging, breaking, hand picking, or use of long lines. All these practices have some indirect effect on eelgrass.
Okay. Thank you. There.
Oops.
I'm going to use this, like this is back and this is forward.
Okay. There we go. All right. research explored using surveys on aquaculture beds and experiments. We surveyed eelgrass and different kinds of aquaculture types within Willapa Bay to look at the effects of different aquaculture practices on eelgrass growth, recovery, et cetera. And what we found is that if you look at, these are all eelgrass density, eelgrass growth, right? Eelgrass biomass, eelgrass production in beds that were either dredge beds, so bottom, long line, hand-picked, or eelgrass beds that were very near where these culture practices were taking place. If you look at how eelgrass responded to these various types of aquaculture, you can see that eelgrass actually had higher growth rates under dredge beds as well as hand picking, and that's because once those beds were disturbed, the eelgrass was released from competition and actually grew better under those conditions. But overall, the density, the biomass, and the production of eelgrass was lower than what you would find in an eelgrass-only type of bed.
Sally?
Yes?
Are we talking about just native eelgrass, but also mm-hmm. japonica?
Japonica was not part of this. In terms, and actually, japonica doesn't really occur that low, so that's one of the reasons why. But as I mentioned, I think spatial scale and temporal scales are important to take into account. And so we looked at that. What we wanted to know is, what is the recovery time of eelgrass under these different aquaculture methods? And so we followed some kind of experimental situations where we went into beds. This is in NEMA, which is in Willapa Bay. We measured eelgrass density, so shoots, before a dredge event. And then we followed those beds through time for 5 years, actually, after the event. And we followed them either in control beds that were only eelgrass, these triangles, or just beds that were dredged, but they weren't, oysters weren't placed on them. So they were dredged, but then oysters were not reintroduced. We also followed it in beds that had a dredge event and then oysters were reintroduced. And what you can see here is that the recovery time of eelgrass was very quick. So within a year, basically we had the same densities as we had prior to the dredge event. So the remaining eelgrass that was left within the bed grew very quickly, spread fast, and within a year was at the densities that it was prior to that event.
Did you say that when it came back it was healthier?
I wouldn't.
Well,
it had the same biomass. Yeah.
It looked healthy.
It looked green. And we also did studies looking at not just the regrowth of eelgrass, but also what would happen in terms of seed production of the eelgrass and in terms of the seedling regrowth within these beds. So did seedlings recruit into the beds? Did they regrow? And one of the things that you can see here is that, yes, in fact, in the dredge beds, the seedlings, seed production went up. There were more seeds in the sediment in the dredge beds, and there were more seedlings in the dredge beds. So this suggests to us that when you remove the adult eelgrass or you reduce it, you're freeing up the growth of seedlings. So seedlings reestablish, and they grow quite well. And that they grew better than in the reference beds, which are, you know, just eelgrass only. They also grew a lot better than in the long lines. So long lines, because long lines allow adult plants to grow, long lines, basically, the eelgrass that grows in those beds outcompetes its seedlings for production. Yeah.
So on the reference beds, though, just to be clear, you weren't clearing those beds to
no.
release the seedlings. They were just growing in amongst the existing
exactly.
adult eelgrass.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I
This, I don't know, on the long, because like she just said, there's no disturbance. There is
of
some,
this,
obviously,
of the floor.
But during the harvest method, there's no disturbing the eelgrass. So what's there tends to stay there. Mm. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's higher biomass of eelgrass in these beds, but there were very few seedlings.
May I ask a fish question?
The point that the eelgrass was highly resilient to the disturbances that were occurring in terms of oyster aquaculture at that bed scale in Wilpa Bay.
If you're looking at fish production, are mature eelgrass beds more conducive than the seedling beds?
Hard to know. I don't know the answer to that, but it would be a very interesting thing to look at. So recovery time. So the message there is that recovery times were pretty quick. Eelgrass recovered from the disturbance of aquaculture at this local scale. But what about the larger seascape scale? What do we see in terms of eelgrass interactions with aquaculture at this very large spatial scale? And at the seascape scale, this work is actually by Brett Dumbald, who I think has talked to you guys previously. The seascape scale, so this is a large scale. This is Stony Point, which is in Wilpa Bay. Here are a bunch of aquaculture plots. Here's the eelgrass overlay. So this is how much eelgrass is in this area. So you can see that there's quite a bit of interaction. And then what they did was they just followed certain plots. So here's an aquaculture bed A, and you can see that the red represents more eelgrass. Aquaculture bed A had a lot of eelgrass in 2005. It was dredged in 2006. You can see there's less eelgrass. But then by 2009, that eelgrass was growing back into those beds. Here's plot B. You can see B had very little eelgrass. It started to grow back. And then by 2009, it was completely covered with eelgrass. These are active beds that are just in different stages of harvest. And then C is an eelgrass-only bed. And you can see that there was a lot of eelgrass in 2005. It was sort of declining in 2006. By 2009, there was a lot less. So there's basically these sort of mosaics, if you will, of eelgrass, cultured and uncultured beds that I think provide a lot of resilience to the eelgrass populations, at least within Wilpa Bay.
May I kind of run down the trail ahead of you a little bit?
Sure.
You've demonstrated it's resilient. What else are your findings?
Yeah, I'm going to do one other last bit, and that is that the estuary location matters. So estuaries vary on our coast in terms of their exposure to ocean upwelling. These are just rich, cold, nutrient-rich waters that enter the bays, and they provide different amounts of phytoplankton and different sea surface temperatures. And so you can see here's a plot of Oregon down into California, and you can see that there are areas that have much colder waters than other areas. There are areas that have a lot more phytoplankton than other areas. And so the amount of phytoplankton production, the amount of cold water that's nutrient rich is going to potentially affect the interaction between oysters and eelgrass. We know from our research that actually eelgrass dramatically varies in terms of its biomass along the coast. So, for example, in Wilpa Bay and Neatarts Bay here, eelgrass is extremely high, has extremely high biomass compared to Yaquina Bay and Coos Bay, which have much lower, even as much as a third less eelgrass biomass. And that's completely driven by ocean upwelling, not driven by anything else but the oceanography of those bays. Yes.
Is that frequency of plant or the robustness of the plant itself in terms
Thank
of
you.
Measuring
so it's biomass?
What do we measure?
How much it weighs,
okay.
Its density, how tall it is, okay. All those things, yeah.
Okay, so back on, I think it was number C, where there was no, nothing, it was just a
right.
Is there anything beyond 2005 that shows life cycles? I mean, you know, natural trends, is it, you know,
yeah,
there, is there like
eelgrass,
like over decades, does it rise and fall, rise and
right.
fall, like everything
great
else?
Question.
We look back at recorded history, but recorded history sometimes
right.
only goes a couple
yeah,
decades.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we started doing the research in, I think it was 2001. We have data for, you know,
a decade or so,
yeah,
a decade and a half.
But no, there's not.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, people can do aerial photo analysis and look at.
Yeah, and it sometimes we become so reactive to it, something that we don't realize is a decades long
right.
trend when we only have a half a decade or.
Sure.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. I don't know. I kind of, as a farmer, I feel like, you know, grass is migratory, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to move, because mm-hmm. what I see a lot is we'll go into an area and it's nothing but mud, and then we plant oysters, and I come back 2.5 years later, now it's covered up with grass.
Grass, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that leads to one of our regulatory challenges, is we're supposed to map these eelgrass beds before we plant. But once they're mapped, they're eelgrass beds. There's
right.
no changing it. But we all know
but they
that
change.
They change.
Well, it has become restrictive, even with our maintenance dredging in a boat base.
Yeah.
And we're at a,
yeah.
if we rip up one blade, we got to replace three. And
that's
what's
yeah.
getting difficult.
That's why I'm struggling to understand
right.
its.
Is it migratory? It tends to.
It's moves. Yeah.
I think it grows very quickly. It responds quickly. It's, you know, it recovers.
Right.
It can. Recruitment into areas with seedlings, like I showed earlier, and you get a lot more seedlings when there's not many adult plants there, as long as the conditions are good for that.
Dr. Hacker,
species.
I'm trying
yeah.
to understand. So different parts of the coast have more or less upwelling.
Right.
And when I look at your arrows, am I assuming the less upwelling, the more biomass, or the more upwelling, the more biomass?
Yeah.
The more upwelling, the less biomass.
Yeah, and so there's,
okay.
this is a pattern that's been shown quite a bit. And you'll notice, so the eelgrass are these dots. This is macroalgae. This is ovoid macroalgae, so green macroalgae. Wolpa Bay and Neatarts have almost no green macroalgae. Yaquina Bay and Coos have tons. And so one of the questions has been, is eelgrass competing with macroalgae? And that's actually causing the decline of eelgrass in Yaquina and Coos compared to the more northerly areas that
where there's
less
upwelling.
Right. And one of the issues is that the macroalgae really responds to the greater nutrients that are provided through upwelling. So it's a complicated story. It's more complicated than just, you know, it involves oceanography and nutrients and how those two plants react to those.
And there's
conditions.
A limited historical timeline as well.
Right, yeah. There's limited data on the changes. But this graph shows 2006 to 2010. So we followed it for 5 years, which is quite a long time to follow those. And you can see here's Neatarts. We only had actually 3 data points. But you can see with Neatarts, we have very, very high eelgrass biomass, actually some of the highest in any of the bays that we've.
So I'm struggling, and I'm sorry to ask a
no, good
baby question, but up until about 10 minutes ago, I thought if there was a blade of eelgrass damaged, it was over for production, and that's hyperbolic a little bit. And Mike, I think, just said you take out a blade, you got to put back 3. If it is as resilient as your data shows, How did it obtain this sort of super status that any damage to eelgrass precludes production?
I can't answer that.
Well, maybe one of the agency guys can.
Is the reputation not correct?
Yeah, it
no.
seems like the data doesn't support the fragility that is asserted by the agencies.
Yeah. So the eelgrass on our coast is coupled up with eelgrass throughout the world as a submerged aquatic vegetation. There's been a lot of reviews of the ecological values of submerged aquatic vegetation. Zostera marina, in particular this species, was given status as essential fish habitat by the National Marine Fisheries Service, by NOAA. And as part of that, in terms of the implementation of that national policy at the state level, the Department of State Lands, which manages vegetation here in the submerged lands, has put together the mitigation requirements that Mike just talked about. So it's got federal status as a protected habitat, essential fish habitat, and then at the state level, State of Oregon supports that federal policy for no net loss.
Okay, but the science maybe doesn't support the conclusions, and we're all beating the drum about we got to have good science underpinning all of this stuff. And forgive me if I do not have an abundance of confidence in DSL.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to figure out if DSL's requirements exceed the rigor of the federal, and if we need to flag coming back and looking at what DSL did, because if, in fact, we're true to the let science be our guide mantra, the science says highly resilient.
There's been decades of work on the ecology of eelgrass beds. I don't know how to present all of that in a quick summary.
Well, her last 5 years maybe belies ocean conditions change. I mean, if it's the mantra eelgrass equals no production, her science just debunked that.
You can say no development, too, because it's drastically having an impact on our ability to develop the port.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. So I want to flag this as a foundational question.
From the industry side, I don't, at least here in Oregon, I'm not going to speak for Washington as much, but, you know, I've never felt that the state agencies are, like, no production. But that you obviously have requirements you have to meet when you look at these things.
And I might have been making a point.
No, but so, I do agree with your point. It does stop a lot of stuff from happening. Hinders.
And I think there, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that number one, one of the caveats is that we're talking about Willapa Bay, right? That and Willapa Bay and Neatarts have the most eelgrass of all the bays that we've looked at compared to Coos and Yaquina. So the estuary matters. It's an important thing to take into account. And there, the questions remain, how do oysters and eelgrass interact under greater ocean upwelling, so under conditions that we might see in the south, and also under changing ocean acidification? Those are really important things to keep in mind. I mean, you know, potentially we want eelgrass, obviously, because of its potential effect on OA. And then also, would eelgrass recover from oyster aquaculture differently under variable estuarine conditions? So what would we see, for example, in Coos or Yaquina Bay if we looked at this, if we did the same type of research that we've done in Willapa Bay?
But you're also making a very strong case for adaptive management, that we maybe don't have one size fits all, and that if you take in your spatial and estuarine concerns, maybe there's a different set of recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Dr. Hecker, we're about 10 minutes behind,
okay.
So could you maybe have about another minute or two? Thank
These
you.
These are the summary statements, which I think you guys all got the point. So, and I just want to say that this is funded by the Western Regional Aquaculture Center, so USDA, and a bunch of people helped do the research.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate
it. Sally, I can't keep my mouth shut on this issue. What we've seen at the hatchery is we actually pull water in the afternoon when the seagrass is actually taking up the PCO2 out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it actually works.
So you time it to that.
We time it to that, and based on the equipment that we have from Oregon State, we can actually see that just as clear as day.
Mm-hmm.
My point is this, is that we are not dealing with an ocean that used to be what we normally had. The PCO2 levels are up, the water temperatures are up. We believe in the hatchery, and you know, we get crazy sometimes, but we actually believe that the PCO2 is actually driving the grass to become more plentiful,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
We don't see the die-offs, at least I don't see the die-offs in Etards Bay like I used to. Now, Willapaw, I grew up there, and one of the things that we always would see were these big rafts of grass that would come up on the shore. My unscientific observation is that the higher levels of PCO2 are actually feeding the grass, making it more robust and making it healthier. And so what I'm trying to say here is what we have now is not what we used to have.
Yeah, I mean, there's research that's been done looking at the fact that there's greater upwelling, so greater CO2 coming up from deep waters, right? So less oxygen, more CO2, more nutrients, colder water, and, research has been done looking at, over the last 50 years, those events are occurring more and more and more. And obviously, those are the low oxygen events that cause hypoxia, which, is also an issue that people have been talking about.
So you condense all this, and what I'm saying is it's never been better for grass than it is right now.
Yeah, and that could be true.
To me, what we do on the ground and whatnot, or whether it's a port or anything like that, I don't think we're going to be harming too much grass. I really don't. And, I mean, that's take it from a regulatory standpoint, but I just have a hard time believing that we're actually, as an industry,
putting
back
at risk
on the grass and making it worse for the grass. I just don't.
Well,
Dick,
actually,
I'm going to take a question, and then we're going to have to wrap this up and move on. We're getting behind.
Just to summarize what Mark's saying, too, I think that in the past, eelgrass was identified as being very important for all sorts of other aquatic organisms, certainly fisheries. And I think now, even though it is responding positively to this, to ocean acidification, it's also more important than ever to mitigating these impacts, seemingly from Mark's observation, in terms of when they pull water, the better quality water they need here in Etards. And so it's kind of the good news from a double-edged sword. We certainly understood in the past that eelgrass is important for fisheries and these sorts of important aspects within estuaries, but now it's also equally important, or at least it's additionally important for these positive impacts can bring for the impacts we're getting from ocean acidification. So yes, it's very resilient. That's great. That's the good news. It's a disturbance type beast that understands how to deal with these things, but it also brings these benefits for something we're facing and going to continue to face here in the future. So I think that's the point we need to remember.
Perfect way to wrap up this segment. We're going to stand at ease for 5 minutes. Let everybody take a quick break. We'll come back on the record in 5 minutes.
I'm glad you're going to chair it. I think that's good.
Hit the gavel until everybody sits down.
Guys!
I think that
gavel. Yeah, here we go.
Gavel.
Are you ready? Go ahead. We'll call this meeting back to order. The next two items on the agenda are discussions. And the first discussion that we are going to have is regarding best management practices. And Steve has agreed to spearhead this discussion. Then we'll move on to the task force discussion of possible recommendations. And Gil's agreed to take that on and kind of chair that discussion. So, Steve, go ahead and let's start our discussion.
Great. I kept some notes, and I just want to try to do a brain dump up here. I also looked over. Beth kept copious notes as well, so I have a mental picture of some of those. But I just want to kind of recap some of the things that we've talked about here. So let me just start over here on this side. I don't know if you can see this. Can you guys see past this slide?
I can lift that.
Oh. You can raise that up. Thanks, Beth. I could do it myself.
Well, let's see how high we can
get. Thanks. All right. So just regarding that first presentation that I gave really quick, I was calling for an update and revision of the best management practices for commercial shellfish culture and harvest for Oregon as part of the Oregon Shellfish Initiative, one of the tasks laid before us. That's entirely consistent with the language in House Bill 2209 that's given us, in essence, our marching orders. We heard from Margaret that a proposal has been put forward by Bobby Hudson, who is the socioeconomics
professor working with the Pacific Shellfish Institute.
Well,
is that correct?
She's the director of the Pacific Shellfish Institute.
Okay.
Right.
And that project was about $150,000 or so. I want to emphasize a quick point, though. If we took that on as a public entity or recommended it as part of the Oregon Shellfish Initiative, we'd be putting those together as a public product. At this point, the existing environmental codes of practices and best management practices put together by the Pacific Shellfish Growers as a member trade organization, those are private.
Correct.
Correct?
That's absolutely
okay.
Correct.
So there's some legalities there that would be needed. It would be difficult for the Oregon Shellfish Initiative to tackle that without leaning very heavily on the existing work and expertise that's been put together there. So we will be asking for access to a private member product to move it into public arena. We may need some help.
Okay,
to do something like that. That's important. It's important as well that this would be a collaborative process. I outlined in my slides again that would
May I stop you? I've answered my own question. Never mind. Okay.
Senator, this is hearkening back to a conversation we had when we were working on the sage-grouse initiative, and ranchers were not interested in being forthcoming. We put some protections around that information, and it was aggregated, so there was nothing proprietary that was made public. I don't know if that's a discussion, if it's a similar discussion or not, but we've been down that road before.
We could probably use some help along those kind of lines and how to navigate that. I would recommend, of course, as a public process, this be very collaborative, involving the industry, shellfish industry, involving the agencies, involving academics, involving our coastal tribes, our elected officials, and stakeholders who have an interest in the bays and estuaries as well. So like the other groups that have gone forward, they've moved forward with workshop discussion, kind of the Oregon way. We'd have to go through it the Oregon way in that collaborative process. Again, I suggested then that we do this as a component of the Shellfish Initiative. The task force would have to just recommend that we move forward on that when we move our report forward. That's where I was headed there. Mark, can you raise your hand?
Well, I get these ideas, you know, and they get crazy on me, but I'm just thinking, Steve, Mark Labhart and I had this discussion about 2 years ago, and this has to do with the recreational fishery. What would it take to set up something like, say, at Hatfield, where we actually were trying to grow razor clam seed and repropagate some of these beaches? I'm just thinking of this big economic spin that it might have, and how would that weigh into what we're trying to do here? Because you're talking about shellfish. I don't know. It's just, it's kind of something that Mark just jumped me in.
I'm on that as well.
You know, I mean, it's like, it's like, I mean, I grew up on Willapa Bay, and I saw what the economic effect. They sell more beer on a clam weekend than anything else, you know, in some of these stores, and everything's full. But this is a discussion I think it needs to kind of go forward a little bit.
During our work plan, you'll see on our work plan at our next meeting, we have that discussion of wild stocks and cultivation, working with the shellfish hatcheries to cultivate wild stocks, meaning the native Olympia oysters, native bullneck clams, our razor clams. What can we do to enhance the recreational opportunities for recreational harvesters and commercial harvesters who rely on those wild stocks as well?
For sake of transparency, I worked with both Dick and Steve, and we did the native oyster restoration project, I don't know how many years ago, but we did it, and it was successful, and we did it, you know, for just, you know, we got good positive press out of the thing, but there is some discussion now about, you know, bringing back the native oyster and having some, you know, economic viability to it, and then I'll also start thinking, well, you start weighing in with the tribal nations and things like that. This thing could kind of go out, you know, and how would that look with our best management practice procedure at this point in time?
Right. Well, entirely consistent, I think, with the other shellfish initiatives. Just recap real quick, the Washington Shellfish Initiative has a cultivation of wild stock native Olympia oysters, but also for pinto abalone as well. And I think it's certainly on the board for things that we could talk about here, not only for Olympia Oysters.
I'm getting too far ahead of myself.
You're jumping ahead. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, anyways, so just the concept of taking a look at and revising best management practices, I think, is something. That, now, what would those look like? Let's shift on over in terms of thinking about the content. What are some of the major points and topics for the best management practices? I didn't fill out the rest of the list, so we'll have to do that. I just ran out of time. But one of those majors is siting. Which estuaries? We've talked about that in some level of detail already. Commercial oyster and commercial shellfish cultivation is currently allowed in some estuaries and not others, depending on the water quality certification. We haven't had our discussion at the task force level about water quality certification yet, but it's a major, major issue. Alex, you want to mention that in terms of just really quick how that is, how some estuaries are open and others are closed?
Well, we just have to generate a history of water quality and a particular estuary before people can operate in that. So typically that would be at least a year's worth of water quality data collected, and then a pretty comprehensive cataloging of any pollution sources that are around any bay that people wanted to commercially shellfish. And so taking a look at septic tanks, wastewater treatment plant function, agriculture, industrial sources of pollution. So basically just capturing all of that and then categorizing the water quality in that area. So that's required because it's a federal program for any commercial shellfish for human consumption.
Who would require that?
Well, the state does because we follow the federal program, which requires it as well. So
okay, so I'm maybe just drifted for a second. So you do this monstrous pollution inquiry if we were going to do anything for commercial consumption.
Right.
I just don't want it to backfire. I'm at a point where the regulatory framework is so burdensome, and I don't want to start looking at trying to create another shellfish market and kill our dairies.
Right.
To be blunt.
It's a balancing act. And,
yeah, and you've got to trust the guys holding the scale.
The thing of it is, for us, though, we don't have any regulatory authority over these pollution sources. We basically call it the way we see it. So if we go out there and we find that this particular bay is just a no-go area, it's just the pollution there is horrendous or whatever, you know, our recommendation would be that you can't operate there. It's going to be too restrictive. Maybe you would be only open 50 days out of the year or something, because the rest of the time it's just the water quality is too poor. So, and then we would just let it, that would be the way it would have to operate, unless you know, somehow maybe DEQ would be able to tighten things up. But otherwise we can't really go after these places if there's problems. So.
I'm not making a case to grow food for human consumption in a polluted situation. Mm-hmm. I am making a case for not incurring collateral damage in an attempt to try to broaden the commercial applications.
I mean, I think we're lucky in Oregon. In most places, that's not really a concern. And the bays that we're already operating are probably more of the developed industrial places anyway. So if we're looking at other areas, I doubt that's going to be a big deal, but that still has to be done anyway. It's part of the requirements that will be looked at first.
You could use Tillamook as an example of the dairy industry, obviously, but it's gotten better, I don't want to use the term on its own, but through the dairy industry taking better care of what they're doing, not to benefit the oyster industry per se, but just in general.
Yeah, they're under the microscope anyway, even
right.
if there
right.
was no shellfish
right.
program or not.
That's
so.
Right.
So I can build on that too. So we've been talking about which estuaries, but also the location within estuaries is also important. And the Department of Agriculture, with the Big Races and work on behalf of the Oregon Coastal Caucus, has received some funding to fine-tune the location, the line where commercial oyster growing can take place versus where it can't. So we're working on that now, and that information is important. Sally also gave us some information about which estuaries were important in terms of eelgrass production and macroalgae production up and down the coast on those latitudinal gradients. Anyway, so siting is an important issue, and we should talk about that. It should be included as part of the best management practices. If I can scoot down just real quick, just to keep us moving, we also talked about permitting, and that really was the management was the focus of our last Shellfish meeting, task force meeting in Salem. So we've got a lot of recommendations there, and Gil, that's your job to pull that together, huh? Good job. But so we've heard.
Passed that right off, didn't he?
He's good at that.
So just to recap real quick, there are federal permits or comments on those federal permits as well. And Spain mentioned really quickly he's been working on the nationwide 48, the Army Corps of Engineers nationwide permit as well. We have state permitting associated with transport and import of shellfish across from bay to bay or from one state to another to handle the disease issues associated with that. And also permitting required at the local government level, at the counties or the cities, depending on where that land is managed. Separate in there then are the conditions inside the leases themselves. We talked about that term, legacy leases that have been in existence for many generations, a long time, in essence fairly open leases versus new leases that have much more constraints on them in terms of what kind of operations can happen there. Yeah. And it's worth having a look at that, just spelling that out really clearly so folks will understand what's going on there. We talked a little bit about the transfer of leased areas. Some areas, I understand, have not been used for many years, and there's a desire to use those, and that can happen through business arrangements from one grower to another, but it sounds like there's a request or a desire for the state to get involved in some sort of way on those business transactions to make that smoother if arrangements can't be made from one grower to sell it or transfer it over to another. We do have an existing ORS, the use it or lose it clause with that 3-year time frame already exists as a rule in Oregon, but is it being enforced or not? So have a recommendation. Other issues that we've talked about a little bit about the different types of growing operations. Spain gave us just a little quick overview of what happens on his farm in terms of bottom culture, where oysters are grown directly on the bottom versus raised bed long lines, or almost like vineyards up on stakes. There are other types as well, floating culture, as happens up in Yacuna Bay, where it's actually floating out on rafts. Out in the Umpqua Triangle, oysters are grown on floats that are hanging down in that weird little lagoon out there. No contact with the bottom. There are kind of hybrids between those where floating bags are lifted by the tide and scoot over and then make contact with the bottom when the tide goes out, lift it up, drop down again. Lots of different techniques. There are entrepreneurs and lots of folks just kind of refining this. Some techniques are appropriate for areas based on the bathymetry, the topography of the tide flats, how high they are. Spain articulated that by saying you needed +1 or +2 foot.
Oh, yeah, -1.
To be able to physically walk out there. If it's a deep site, you can't grow them a certain way. So certain areas have to be grown in one way versus another. All that information is important. The species of shellfish that are being cultivated, oysters versus clams, which species of oysters? We've talked about native Olympia oysters. The primary oysters being grown are Pacific oysters, non-natives from Japan. We have other oysters.
Kumos.
Yeah, Kumos, that's what I was searching for. I was thinking Crass Austria Sicumia, but Kumamoto oysters. Other species that are being grown. Do we have any area Kensis grown here?
No.
I don't know the Latin names, sorry.
Crass Austria gigas, Pacific oysters, and Crass Austria sicumia, the Kumamotos are the primary ones being grown. In terms of oysters, interesting clams. So we all have our native little neck clams, which are also known as steamers, also the Manila little neck clams, also known as steamers. Interest in those. And a little bit of discussion about growing gooey duck clams as well. So lots of different clams. Anyway, so we have to spell that out just so everybody has a good understanding about what species we're talking about. other BMP groups have also included a section on predators and pests. We do have predators of oysters, predators of clams, some crabs. One in particular, an issue associated with the culture of Manila little neck clams, is that they can be subject to predation by rock crabs and Dungeness crab. In some cases, they need to be protected with nets over the top of them. That may or may not cause some problems with permitting, depending on the level of predators. Pests, so up in Willapa Bay, the issue of cordgrass growing out and encroaching on tide flats has been a big deal. And it's nice to be an Oregonian. We put our foot down and really put the halt on the spread of this non-native grass, cordgrass. There's a little population got established in Coos Bay, right at Barbie Wayside, immediately eradicated out of there. So good job down there. The little population that popped up in Florence, I think, as well, that's also been eradicated by the Nature Conservancy for a long time. So anyways, but Zostera japonica, Sally, will you just describe real quick the difference between Zostera japonica and Zostera marina?
Yeah, so japonica grows in the high intertidal and doesn't necessarily overlap with marina because it's higher in the intertidal. And it's has a lot lower biomass, very thin blade, about that tall, versus the eelgrass, which is, you know, a meter.
It's a real problem on clam ground.
Yeah.
Japonica.
It's increasing a lot, really increasing a lot in Willapa Bay. I don't know about our bays. I know that in Yaquina, it's a player there. It's there, but I don't know what it's like here in Neatarts.
It's a player in Neatarts, but
yeah.
It's not taken over.
Yeah.
Okay, and then just to wrap up real quick, seafood safety, really important, you know. And again, that's back in the Department of Agriculture and Frank and Alex's arena to make sure that the products that are grown, shellfish growers, of course, don't want anybody to get sick, but it's their job to ensure the testing, and they work very closely with the commercial industry to obtain those samples for testing of fecal indicator bacteria, noroviruses, others as well. Yep.
If we're thinking about keeping a list for money, in with that seafood safety, I'd like some additional money for enforcement. The playing field needs to be level. And we've got some folks that are getting away with not playing by the rules, and others are forced to incur a substantial expense for playing by the rules. And how those rules are applied is important.
Certain growers are paying and other growers are not?
No, I'm aware of a couple of instances in my district where there are live bivalves kept in tanks that are sold, and questions have been raised about the food safety there, and they're getting away with it, and commercial growers are struggling. I just want to make sure that there's an equitable playing field.
Is that a problem other places?
Oh, there's always bad actors places, and so others who are
just
doing the right
to be
thing
mindful
are
here.
Well,
more.
And perhaps what I have you and their discharge, if that's not applied equitably, we are, these are their new rules. I mean, they've been asleep since 2011 and now decided they want to redo the rules. If those are not applied equitably, we are going to put different businesses at substantial disadvantage.
Well, I think to take note, I know everybody knows that we just got a new OSP fish and game officer strictly for the marine side of it, and he's kind of running out of Garibaldi. And just watching him try to get caught up, he is running all up and down the state. So it's really, we know this is an issue. Just for the front line, different sort of folks, they're tasked with a huge area to cover. So,
well, and it isn't just seafood. I mean, I'm speaking to a legislative colleague, and on the record here, it's poaching of big game. It is, and at a time when we ought to be beefing up our field staff for critters out of OSP, we're cutting them.
Third.
Yeah. We get, especially if we try to promote number five, the other species, I mean, OSP is struggling to do oysters right now if we throw clams in there too. We give them $25,000 a year to do our shellfish patrols.
Yeah, which is
nuts. That's crazy. Yeah. But before they were getting nothing from us, and they came to us and said, we need something from you guys, and so that's not very much at all.
Well, and the woods are getting to be increasingly dangerous places. I know that has nothing to do with fish, but they've got mushroom foragers out there, and people shooting game and just carving hunks off and leaving it. And it's dangerous for a single trooper to be anywhere anymore.
So put that on the money side.
Hey, I'll just wrap it up real quick. Other issues, very important issues, water quality criteria, just to make sure that everybody on board understands the criteria that are used for fecal indicator bacteria for dealing with and testing for viruses, again, to ensure seafood safety, protect the growers as well as protect the public. This issue should also be addressed, user group conflicts. We talked a little bit about recreational harvesters inside commercial growing areas, those kind of things. Mark's nodding his head. We've worked on that issue here. That's been front and center here in Etarch Bay as well. Other user group conflicts, we could have a whole meeting about that. And then finally, to identify some of the research gaps that are particular to Oregon. I think it was Bill. Bill, you mentioned that the Pacific Shellfish Institute has compiled a document of research needs. My understanding is that's out for review right now to identify needs for the group that has funded Sally's work and others as well. But anyways, those specific research needs for Oregon, I have not looked through that document with fine-tooth comb from my perspective as an Oregonian to see whether or not their proposed research agenda would meet our needs. But we should do that as well. Do you know what the time frame is for review comments? Sally, do you know, or anybody knows? Margaret, do you know how long that's open? Anyways, there's an opportunity for us to comment on the Pacific Shellfish Institute's identification of research needs. We should do that as well.
For number two there, should we be adding, aside from permitting, but kind of identifying every single state, federal, and local agency that has regulatory
so Mike, a
bite over them?
So you weren't at our last meeting.
We missed that, yeah.
Yes, but that's what we did. So we spent that whole time, and that's what Gil's going to talk about here as well. So again, I just wanted to cap
perfect
some of the discussion here. And,
thank you.
Beth, can you take pages away?
Are we putting the eelgrass piece?
Oh, sorry.
This is the high level that's going to get filtered down as we come to a recommendation in a couple of months. So if there's anything you all want to add to this right now, this is time to take a quick look, throw it in. If anything comes to mind in the next few days or week or two as we move forward, Beth's going to compile all this information, so get a hold of her if there's anything else you choose to add.
And Beth, when you do this, you're going to keep in mind monetizing some of this so that we know what kind of a comprehensive fiscal ask to have in the Ways and Means process.
One of the things that we've been talking about is how to start kind of transferring some of this money as we start making things that were kind of not necessarily recommendations, but that we're getting more comfortable with. This is something areas we really want to kind of start laying that out sooner rather than later so that the agencies can kind of start helping us actual put dollars to that. So that is something we're trying to.
I think we may need to do that sooner rather than later because the agencies are doing their budgets right now.
Yes.
And how these activities would get prioritized within the relevant agencies remains to be seen. We may have to do a little outreach with the directors to make sure that it's adequately elevated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I add one more? Claire raised up one that was on my list, and I just missed it as it moved from one page to another. But this issue about environmental impacts, both positive and negative, as Sally is pointing out, for dealing with oyster eelgrass, but also other issues associated with nutrients, fish is a big concern. There's lots of work going on, seabirds as well. That's important.
So just to make sure I understand, Steve, that our potential recommendation could be developing best management practices for Oregon.
Right.
And that elements that would be in there would be these topics.
Oh,
and these would be for discussion. Not as part of the recommendation. We may have recommendations on all these topics separately from what may go into a BMP document. Because the DMP document would take place in the next year or two if we implemented it, if we got funding for it. But these would all be elements. So there's a big overlap, obviously, with DMPs and all the other elements that this committee put out.
That's great. Great.
So just one more thing, maybe in the eelgrass that I heard come up was a desire to have regional or look at within maybe the science needed, the regional rather than statewide eelgrass regulation, I think I heard come up.
In support of that, I can add California has developed their eelgrass policy at the state and federal level, and they've drawn a distinction between Southern and Central California and Northern California. We're more similar in parts of the state to Northern California, but other parts more similar to Washington. So we again could draw on both our rivers.
And it sounds as though most of the research has been done in Washington, not here. Maybe some in Neatarts, is that correct? Maybe there's an investment that we need to make in Steve making that differentiation between these ecosystems that are more like Northern California or more like Washington and how that impacts what we do.
The research is an evolving landscape because we learn more and then we know what to look for more. But some of the original work that looked at ecological impacts of commercial shellfish growing was done right here in Tillamook Bay. It was done by the partnership and it's done by Battelle Industries. Came down and did that work right here. And Coos Bay also figured very heavily in this as well, working with Larry Coleman and his group in South SLU, looking at the effects of racks and stakes. So there's been quite a bit of work in Oregon as well, but not all of the aspects. So some of it's here when you have some major gaps. Yep.
So I'm going to ask for ag. Are you guys adequately funded for all your inspecting? And do you have enough manpower to cover the coast?
We are actually short staffed wise, and we have put in a legislative pop for another position, yes,
and for some of that funding.
We fall below what the FDA would look at us as for the number of inspectors for the size of the permits that we have in this state. And if we were to probably jump up a little bit on this discussion here, where we're talking about some of the water quality issues, we would probably want to ask for another FTE for that position in addition to the ones we've already asked for. This would be more for the permitting and the water quality side of it, because the permitting, if we look at changes with that and leases particularly, that requires a lot of work that would have to add another FTE to do all of that.
Frank, the pilot program we're doing in Tillamook Bay now that we funded short term, so are you talking about in essence taking that pilot and expanding it where there's more testing more often to make sure that water's open quicker?
We're not really there yet. We're trying to see how well that pilot works out in Tillamook Bay.
Okay, so this is something different you're talking
right
about. Okay, all right.
Well, what I'm talking about is how we talked about the additional need for those changes in the permit. That's not something that we do in food safety, but that's something that the ODA does and would require another FTE to be added to our funding purposes.
Because I think there were people... There was interest in ODA being this one-stop shop,
yes,
for shellfish lease. And so that would be that we would take over some of what DSL is doing, and that ODA would basically be the umbrella for all of that coordination.
Yeah.
And we don't have that capability right now.
It's not that we're resistant to that. We actually see some positive outcomes with that.
Mm-hmm.
Just we would need more funding for that purpose.
I'd like to make that a recommendation,
sure,
to do the one-stop shopping. Get DSL out of this line of work. You could leave open some possibility for some conversation, but I would like, in an ideal world, to see ODA be the one-stop shop.
It's a good recommendation, and I did talk with Lauren, and Lauren and Katie haven't had an opportunity to discuss it fully, but I believe they're agreeable to some sort of move that way.
Can you run that up the flagpole?
Mm-hmm.
For Alex, on the water sampling side, I know we told Muck it's monthly, Coos Bay it's monthly. The industry's doing that pretty much now. How does
does FDA feel about that, I guess? Is there ever, is that going to become an issue to where, or is this part of your adding one more person to where they're going to be doing the sampling?
If you're opposed to it, no.
No, because we look at the people who collected and have some control over those collections. And we still are taking the samples and running them in our lab, so the control is there. It's not something that we would want to do away with. We probably would want to increase it over time. But again, that's contingent on what the industry would feel that they could do extra for us also.
Okay.
It's not an easy thing to go out there and collect those and then get them to the lab in a time frame that they can analyze them and be good regulatory samples. So it's just another area where we would need more people to do more things, and that's not necessarily where we're going to get to quickly.
Isn't this one of those options we talked about, like with Claire and the school student programs of partnering on something like that?
Yes.
I know it sounds easier than it really is, but I mean, are there some other opportunities outside the normal?
There might be other opportunities, but again, that's something that we would run through our federal partners to, who look at how we manage and oversee this program.
The sampling, I mean, I'm all for bringing students in on stuff.
Not on this, though.
Yeah.
From my point, since I'm running them as a business.
You need to be doing it.
Well, safety and liability. And Alex will vouch for it. I go, personally, I'll go out on days when Alex is like, I'm not going with you.
Well, and in a perfect world, if we could replicate that in every estuary and bay, that would be great. You have a unique experience because you have Claire here, which is wonderful. But Claire's not available with
everywhere.
That everywhere. And
and it's hard. Sometimes Alex will call me in the, 7 in the morning and be like, you need to go right now. And
we're going to cut Dr. Sylvia short here if we don't move on. But there is one thing that Beth brought up that was a topic. I want to see if we want to add it. And it had to do with a pilot and the ability to innovate without opening up a permit.
Oh.
Is that something we want to include?
You mentioned that maybe that you wanted the option to be able to experiment to try to do something more creative.
Yeah, have a test plot option.
However you want
to. So let's put it under number two.
Under two, under permitting, Steve, under number two. Which would be the innovationite aspect.
Are you groaning? What you're?
Yeah.
But I was suggesting it should go under number
under
two.
Number two.
It's really related to number two.
Yeah.
But I guess the groan was, are these in any particular order? Should there be a prioritization of these? Can these all be accomplished?
I'm a little concerned that Gil was supposed to have 45 minutes, and he's now down to 20.
I groan.
So what I would suggest is that... we have a conversation about prioritization. We send it out to everyone, get some feedback. I mean, we have great staff who can get information out and ask you what you think.
Sounds
okay.
Good.
All right.
So,
Dr. Silva.
Just for my clarity,
all right.
Again, some of these possible recommendations, look, there's a lot. This is a complex issue, right? The more we sit in on this, I'm looking at Senator Betsy Johnson, say it's complicated.
It's complicated.
For both of you.
Yeah.
And some of this we may not resolve. And if I'm hearing this correctly, some of these issues, like the one we just raised, do you do testing or not? Is that a recommendation that this group would make coming into the legislature, or do we say we're going to delay that, have that part of be this larger best management practice conversation? Is that why you're listing these up here, Steve, getting back to what
we're trying
to do?
I think at the task force level by October that we should just go forward and say we recognize a need and value for updating best management practices. Straw man within that might be these issues were raised up and talked about by our group here. But as that process moved forward over the next couple of years, these would get fleshed out. One of the issues is in terms of the permitting and management is on our agenda already. And that's, again, Gil, what you're going to talk about here. But we don't have to do that. We don't have to solve that, by October. We just have to put it forward as a component of the Shellfish Initiative in Oregon. Yeah.
We're still thinking big.
You're still what? Thinking.
We're still thinking big. This is going to get narrow.
So we have, there's these five subcommittees, right, that the group has. Mm-hmm. And so one of those committees is the Management Regulation and Collaboration Committee. And so I'm looking at Mike, it's Finn, and let's see who else, Frank, and who else is on, Jess, I don't think she's here, right?
He's not here today.
So we haven't met as a group to really talk about this whole issue of regulation management. It's complicated. But what Beth did from the last meeting, she took the recommendations that came out of the agencies that presented, and we had also Dick representing the Nature Conservancy also providing recommendations. So, and she put this, so Beth put this this list together, right? Does everyone have a copy of this?
Yeah.
She sent it to us, or everyone got a copy?
Does everybody have a copy?
And these recommendations basically follow the five top major topic areas that this group has to work on. Right, so the first one being the recommendations and encouraging collaboration for recommendations that particularly relate to the state agencies and their role. And then the other ones have to do with research and be the best management practices. So we won't talk about those recommendations, right? Or do we want to talk about the whole list? There's more than 40 recommendations that just came out from the regulatory agencies and their presentations, and TNC, not even from industry. We haven't really, in fact, we haven't probably heard an industry presentation of their possible recommendations. I just want to note that. Go ahead, Steve.
We did. So we asked during our second meeting in Newport for those recommendations from Peter Moore, and Peter offered up the selection of lead agency. There were four recommendations. Mm-hmm. Margaret, do you remember what those were?
I wasn't here. I don't.
So they were offered up. If I can trace through my mind, they were select a lead agency, which is consistent
is
here,
mm-hmm.
to look at the species, to look at areas, and I don't remember what that fourth one was.
We can go back and look
yeah.
at those
yeah.
and add them to the list for us to consider. But there may be other industry guys who have other recommendations, right? So those were his. I don't know, Sven's not here at the moment, but he may have some also mm-hmm. as part of this committee.
I just found them. I found my notes. So they were solidify the role of the Oregon Department of Agriculture as lead agency. Second, to look at the closure issues, the window of time frames when waters are closed to fecal indicator bacteria.
Yeah.
Third was certification of additional ground. And then fourth was evaluate new species.
Okay.
I don't know
we
if that's
all those, yeah.
consistent,
good.
Margaret, with you. But
yep.
I'll add those
that's
to the list for us to consider, particularly for, and what I'm going to suggest to our subcommittee is we're probably going to have to meet and maybe come back after a conference call or something and look at the long list and maybe and some way that we might, the question will be which ones that does the committee ultimately want to deal with and maybe be part of any recommendation now versus those that might be part of a longer conversation over the next few years that might be part of the best management practice conversation.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right. As Senator Johnson just touched on, there's a budget being developed right now for 17-19. So there's the very short term. And then there's going to be the long term, which the initiative will look at over time. So if we can be mindful of that, see if those things that we can pull out that we can actually get into a budget request for this session, it would be helpful to know how you all want to prioritize those. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So I think, what I might suggest for our subcommittee is we get a conference call and talk, get the list together, and then have some way to come back to this committee with maybe a discussion about how we prioritize those. Are we missing anything? And then anything else you want to add and then prioritize for discussion. What might go into our recommendations now in the next legislative session? What might be part of longer term? So given that, I would focus on the first, what Beth had put together, which is this first set of recommendations. There's 14 here under basically that are associated with regulations. So, for example, and the top one being that ODF, that Oregon Department of Ag should continue to serve as the lead state agency, right? So, I don't think we've heard anything different than that. So that's a pretty important one because that's right in our task that we're supposed to consider. So I don't know how we want to review these, given the limited amount of time we have. We have 14 of these that were recommended. I could comment about a couple. Does anyone want to comment on any of these 14 that are in this list now or add to them?
Yeah, let's
everybody
go
had
ahead.
A chance to read them before you got take a
peek. So in number one here says ODFW and Oregon Department of Ag. Is that combined?
So is it, sorry.
Sorry,
no, this,
we have an explanation.
So that was me. Sorry, I was trying to make sure that so that way if you had questions, that was who had sent me the recommendation. So some of these are
came
kind of duplicative as well. And so rather than me streamlining them on my own, I thought I would just leave them verbatim from where they came, but that there's definitely going to be overlap within the document. But if you have questions, that would be the appropriate person.
But it's interesting that one state agency, ODFW, had made and seems to be supporting the recommendation that it be ODA taking the lead.
Okay.
So we're not seeing a conflict here.
It's not a conflict. It's a collaboration, and we work very well together.
So the first eight recommendations are ODFW's, and the next
are ODA's,
right.
And that goes to the entire document. So when you see Nature Conservancy dash, it means the Nature
right.
Conservancy.
Suggested
that's
that.
Right.
Good to know.
Right.
Thank
right.
you. Right. Just wondering that too.
Exactly. Right.
Just for the record, Steve, I don't have a problem with you, but ODFW, I do. Okay.
I think most growers would mirror that. I had this on number four for clarification. Conduct routine field visits, commercial leases, ensure productivity and compliance with the conditions of the lease. I'm not sure how anybody would gauge productivity short of talking to the grower, but for the actual visits, are we talking ODA, ODFW, or an OSP trooper? What's the thought process behind it is what I'm wondering.
I wrote that in there. So there's that issue associated with just a site visit.
Right.
And I don't know who would do that. You know, that could be.
Well,
I guess if
it's verifying compliance, is there any type of administrative that has to be a law enforcement person, or could it be Alex coming out?
Probably would be a field person.
We're actually supposed to be doing that, and we're not. Basically, to make sure that people are operating within where the boundaries of their lease are described, so they're not claim jumping or whatever, and that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, and just making sure their boundaries are marked. And just
we do run over when we do our water samples.
Whatever enforcement agency's tasked with it has to have the authority to cite. That simple. I mean, if you're going to do enforcement, they have to have the authority under state statute to issue citations.
And I don't. Is it clearly spelled out what? I mean, is it monetary fine? Is it probation?
Civil penalties.
Yeah. What is the?
That's something we can look up.
Yeah.
Beth can bring that.
Yeah. Assuming you don't pull the permit if he's an inch over the line by mistake or something. I mean, there has to be some sort of a
double secret probation kind of thing.
Yeah. I like
the
that.
The vines should be clearly delineated if they're there.
Because that can't really happen until the GIS work is done anyway.
So, Gil, I just want to clarify one thing. You said, I really don't have a problem with ODFW, but I do have some problems with some opinions about eelgrass. That's where the rub is.
I think there are some concerns. Yeah.
And anyway, I mean, there's a lot of people I know in ODFW I like, and I get along with just fine. It's the certain opinions that come out in the permitting process. That's the problem.
Well, and that's, again, I think an issue with multiple agencies. You don't know, it's like whack-a-mole. You don't know where to go.
Well, are you saying that there tends to be a
bias?
Well,
there's personal opinions.
Too much wiggle room for personal opinion to affect the outcome.
Yeah.
And we know that's true. I mean, it's you're seeing that in here.
So the good point. So how do we frame the eelgrass issue in a way that, in terms of a recommendation as part of the regulatory and management process, given that I think as we heard, it's a complex question and issue, including the science
mm-hmm.
under it, and with respect to how it affects industry. So what does this, just taking the eelgrass issue as one of many, but an important one, how do we frame that question in terms of for this committee to take that up or even potentially to make a recommendation?
Well, I think one of the, it's back to the research gaps. I think that part of that's contingent upon us to find money for research to differentiate between the geography of where the estuaries are and what's happening and how that impacts is something we don't have the data, it doesn't look like.
Is whatever this Morris Indu going to have the bite to affect state policy on eelgrass management, or is there going to be a whole other committee, a whole other program?
There's a federal overlay, so
I mean, it sucked we did all of this and then something else came out that just negated everything we did because of a different management practice.
Certainly.
Could happen.
It could happen, yeah.
So I didn't know whether, I mean, my thought about just thinking out loud about eelgrass issues, it reminds me of the question of developing a standard versus prescription. This gets back to the complexity of the whole regulatory process here, because you can make, this process can be really complicated if you try to prescribe all the activities and rules and regulations that may work with existing technologies or existing practices or existing science, but may not be applicable 10 or 20 years later. And so if you look at eelgrass, do we care, is it the eelgrass associated just with that site that we really care about, or do we care about, I think, the seascape issue of eelgrass broadly within an estuary? So that if growers can operate in an area without farming, doing, you know, excessive impact to eelgrass, can they still farm that area in terms of oyster production? I guess I'm looking at you, Steve, to try to understand.
Yeah, I can add to this real quick. So I've been working with the Coast Seafood folks down in Northern California on the Humboldt Bay issue, where this is front and center. Typically, there are impacts at the level of oysters themselves, you know, at the quadrat, 1 square meter. As you get bigger and move away from that, scale up to the scale of a plot or to a tide flat. We manage by tide flats typically, or eelgrass beds as ecological functional units, and then scale that up to a subregion of an estuary, you're looking at these spatial relationships that Sally was talking about. Mm-hmm. So they're typically impacts at the, you know, at this level, but less and less and less as you get bigger. What scale matters? That's, we don't
right.
know yet.
What scale matters?
What scale matters?
And does this committee have anything to say about that in terms of recommendation, in terms of how to approach this issue?
So that's front and center, and again, we should watch what's happening down in Humboldt Bay. There are hundreds and hundreds of pages of discussion along that point, including ecological modeling for light, for the nutrient dispersion things. It's very sophisticated down there in terms of trying to get to an answer about this.
But Svein, did I hear you say in this discussion that you're growing your oysters where you want to grow them, basically how you want to grow them, in harmony with all of the eelgrass issues, that it's just not been it's not stopping you?
I like the last part you just said, harmony. Yeah. Yes and no. Some of our plats are what Alex described as so old that there was no restrictions on them when they were grandfathered.
Jess was here, because I'd like to find out what's going on down south.
I think Coos Bay is pretty much the same, because a lot of those plats are through the county, not the state. Some of our more recent plats have this and that restriction on it. What can you mechanically harvest? Can you grow long lines? Can you do this?
In the big scheme of things, is this a big problem for you?
The eelgrass issue?
Yeah.
It can potentially be, yes, because where it's limiting us, where we see it as an industry limiting us, is expansion. If you're already there prior to X date, you're kind of grandfathered in unless they change something. But if I have 100 acres and I'm a small mom and pop operation and I've only been farming 50 of it, but now all of a sudden my son wants to get in, so now I'm going to do another 50,
mm-hmm.
that's an expanded farm.
So that's when you're going to have a problem.
That's when you have a problem. And then you map your eelgrass bed 1 year.
And
now it's on record, but it changes. Yeah. You still cannot go back.
And that's
that
where
area.
The rub is, because
right.
you're looking at static information, and it's not static.
Right.
Right.
And if I may add to that a little bit, what we're seeing along the whole West Coast is some regulatory language that says presence of eelgrass or potential for eelgrass. Well, because it
can grow in, yeah.
changes,
based on all these other conditions that you're talking about, that potential for eelgrass excludes an enormous amount of ground that could be cultivated.
And we could probably spend an hour on eelgrass, and we now have about 3 minutes before we're supposed to go to lunch.
Right.
So.
So I think so. Here's another one that maybe is low-hanging fruit nine, eight. Hold pre-application meetings among applicant agents. Are we in agreement that that probably does make logical sense? We can make that recommendation for our task force report right up front without having to deflect it. As it's just one example, because I don't. Or is that an issue that's going to increase costs? Let's say ODA is leading that effort. Is that going to be a cost item for this to have a recommendation?
I'd rather pay the smaller amount up front, do the pre-app meeting, than to have a whole lot of kerfuffle later and agency time doing investigations, mediations, adjudications, litigation.
And is that and so, well, follow up. Who pays that? Is that an agency cost or is that the applicant's cost to help support pre-application meetings?
Well, I think we ought to price it before we start spending other people's money.
There you go.
You're from academia. It doesn't matter, right?
Oh, yeah. It does matter. That's a lot.
So that's something we will put on our two price list.
And then you've got a couple of recommendations here in terms of this, both the county mapping for GIS, putting these county maps together, updating that, and there's big price tags. It's going to be
I'll tell you, there are counties who cannot do that.
Could I ask for a reaction from a county commissioner who sits on AOC's board?
What was that again?
The question about having the counties pay for everything that has to do with the regulation. Mapping.
Mapping of estuaries.
Mapping, Mark.
Nobody answered.
Yeah, we're poor. We don't have any money.
Okay.
But these are recommendations coming from the agencies. They're going to come back to the counties for helping to fund this.
And I don't know how that has to be, but I do know that I paid a local surveyor about $1,500 to survey out about 1,800 acres worth of property on the bay and then put it on a map. So I guess I don't know where the huge cost in prohibitiveness is in this, unless I'm missing something, because I can do GIS on my computer real easy. Just read a description, on legal description, type it in.
We probably ought to price this again.
Right. If you're adding that information, the county has to have the whole platform and the software and the technical, you know.
Yeah.
So if you're adding it and everybody else is adding it, are you all adding
it? No. I'm saying I bought GIS software for $400 and figured out how to use it.
We're going to get farther and farther
behind.
And just read the legal description, typed it in, so I don't know what the big cost is.
I happen to be in the neighborhood.
Oh, hi.
Hi there. You're
Representative
just
Dave Bomber.
You've done all the work.
Well, we're just wrapping up, and we're going to go to lunch. So
we were just working on Cape Kiwanda, trying to keep people from climbing out there and falling off. So. Yeah.
Well, here's what I would suggest. So how's this for a way to wrap up? We're due to go to lunch right now. I want to reiterate my earlier warning that we have guidelines around public meetings law. So when you go to lunch, we're not talking about these issues anymore. It's a meet and greet and go have some fun. Could your subcommittee come together and review this and anything else that you think was left out, and come to our next meeting with a set of recommendations that you have prioritized?
So I'm looking at some of the members here, so I'll be in touch with you guys. We'll set up a conference call.
Okay.
And I think, again, the issue will be to get the list, and it'll be from the past notes and other discussions.
Which is great. And Beth's got all the past
besides
notes.
Besides what Beth has put together, maybe you can help us put some of this together.
We've got Peter's
I'll call you first, Beth.
Yeah, recommendations.
And then we'll put this list together for the committee, and then we'll discuss it and come up with a draft set of priorities, just for discussion. It's not saying we're right. It just gets that started, both in terms of what we want to prioritize, particularly as for the report that needs to be acted on now versus those things that maybe need to be acted on over a much longer time period.
And then, Steve, I'd suggest you can you do that same thing?
Sure.
Prioritize them, come with, okay. That sounds good.
I don't know if it works or not, but I have GoToMeeting available. Perfect. To where, and I could pass the presenter to whoever has something on their computer to show.
That's a great program.
Right, right.
Thank you.
So we'll set it up like that. So whoever wants to do that, set up like that.
It'll have a call-in number and everything, yeah. Too. So.
Oh, you want it set? You want to set that up?
I wanted to say I have it. I don't know if you have it available or not, too.
Oh, you have it?
We can talk about GoPro during the lunch. That's allowed. So.
All right, so I'll start with you guys. We'll set this up, and we'll work together, and then we'll get together with the committee, and then we'll present the next meeting, you said, right?
This is such an interesting topic. We tend to cram a whole lot in, and we are not we need to have longer meetings. So at this point, I want to thank all the committee members. We are heading down to the Schooner for lunch. So please just head on down there, and then we'll go on to our tour. Any parting words, Senator Johnson? Anybody, anything for the good of the order? All right, we are adjourned.
Hey, Marco.
Yeah. Yep. It should be nice.
Marco.
Yeah. Yep. It should be nice.